This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. With me, I have Zoe Carr, the High Performance Coach for the Country Women. Welcome, Zoe.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Darren Best, the High Performance Coach for the Vic Metro Men. Welcome, Bestie.
Morning.
Morning. He's a little croaky this morning, so we will forgive him there. We also have the man behind the lens, Jared Potter, in the podcast booth this morning. Podcast booth, also affectionately known as the Gaze Room. And this is Season 7, Episode 4, Week 4 of me complaining about how warm it is in the Gaze Room. We seem like we go through this every week, but eventually we'll get some climate control in here so that we won't come out of the sauna that is this room. Coaches, we do appreciate all the listens, the ratings, the reviews, the likes, the shares, the subscriptions. You can get us via the hashtag TalkingSplit on social media. You can get me on at Rob Coulter on Twitter. You can get Zoe on
at ZoeCar85.
And you can't get Bestie at all. He's still continuing his love-hate, which is more heavily in the hate direction towards Twitter, which is understandable too. So, coaches, we are talking about session planning today. So this is the kind of my love of coaching personally. I love the planning side of things. I love designing a session. I love going into to what it should look like, knowing that every coach will have their own little sort of tweaks to it. You can almost tell who's written a session plan as when you look at it, and it's like, yeah, I know this is one of Coops's, or I know this is one of Bestie's, or I know this is Zoe that's done that. You can have a look, because it is a little bit of a personal thing too. So what we are looking at is what it should look like for our coaches out there, why they're important, like all those types of things. So you guys are a little different, I suppose, in how you would design your session plans, given you guys work in camp formats a fair bit, given you work in largely skill development and talented identification in that space as well. So it might be a little bit different for some of our coaches out there, which is actually a good thing. I kind of like that you might come at it from a different angle from what they are potentially looking at it from as well. So we'll start out with you on this one, Zoe. Why is it important to plan your training sessions in the first place?
Well, I think going into a session with no plan leaves you almost rudderless, and you come out of that with no, you know, not has you, yeah, there's a feeling of not having achieved anything. So I think you say in courses all the time, there's no more lonely or frightening feeling when you don't have your plan and the team's gone and got a drink and they're on their way back out and you don't know what's next. So if you're looking to achieve anything in your session, whether that be from a micro or macro perspective, you have to plan it out. Otherwise, you'll miss detail, you'll miss drills, your session won't make sense. You might bounce around from things, you know, offense to defense to, you know, shooting to defense again, back to offense rather than have it flow. And when you have those sort of things, it also makes it less enjoyable for the athletes, might make them even a little bit bored. So having that sort of plan just keeps you on track, and it means you can come out of your session knowing you got better at something than when you started.
And no giving away coaching course content. Apologies. Free, please. We want to try and get as many coaches through our accredited coaching courses as we can. But I mean, you've been around a long time in coaching, Bestie. Do you feel like you could probably go and run a session without a session plan at this stage, or do you still put the time and the effort into planning something out?
I mean, I could, but it's taking what is sacred about our profession and spitting in its face. I think, you know, like, it's showing care is the first thing why you would have a session plan. So I never do it. I always have a session plan, even if it's, you know, you start one way and go another, at least you still have a plan to start with. And just piggybacking off the back of what Zoe said, when the players come back from their drink, if they know what you're going to do, that's even worse, because that means you're just doing the same thing all the time, and most likely it's what you're comfortable with, which is a real danger that you can fall into as a coach when you're planning your sessions. You just do what you're comfortable with, not necessarily what your group needs. So if you go through the process of planning it, there's some thought behind what your group needs, and you're more likely to stick to it because there's some little resources there for you to try it.
And you do need the ability to come up with things on the run, because especially in the junior landscape, you know, courts get double booked, or, you know, half of it, the roof's leaked or something, you know, kids don't turn up because they're sick or there's cars broken down, or so the session plan you have may change, and you do have to have the ability to make those changes. But if you have a plan, and for instance, you had, say, 3-on-3 in it, and 20 minutes before practice, two kids pull out, well, now okay, I need, instead of 3-on-3, I can move that down to 2-on-2, but how do I get this detail into the 2-on-2? And it just helps you with that adjustment rather than just trying to make something up completely on the spot with sort of no idea or no direction.
For context, I am coaching a team this year, which has been the first time in a number of years. Strap in for the Rob Season and Review podcast, because that might be over about 5 or 6 different episodes. But it is a case of I still plan out training sessions on my end because I am working with a team. But I've probably stopped going to the – like I am a detail-oriented person. I like having a session plan. I love putting together a session plan. I get a lot of enjoyment out of doing that because you can have some fun with it. You try and work out what you need, how you could do it, can you do it differently. I must admit this year I've stopped typing out my session plans and having it immaculately presented. I think I did it for the first month and then it just became – I'd get continual bailouts half an hour before practice. And it's like, okay, I now can't do that drill because I don't have players. I can't do that, can't do that. And now it's as simple as I just take my notebook with me before every training session. Okay, half an hour beforehand. Right, now I'm good. Now I'm confident that, you know, at most I'll have one kid bail, maybe not 2 or 3. Now I'm content to sort of write down roughly where I think I'm going with this, what the drill is going to look like, those types of things. So there's still, you know, it doesn't have to be insanely formatted or anything like that. Great if you have the time to do it, but being aware as well, a lot of our coaches are volunteer coaches. So they may not have the time or the resources necessarily to go into planning a training session the same level as you guys do, but you can still get something done just so that you know what's coming next. And Investi, how important is the flow of a training session? Like you don't, I mean, Zoe alluded to it a little bit before, you don't want to go from like a shooting drill to a defensive drill, then back to an offensive drill, then into something different. Like how much time do you spend sort of rearranging the content within your training session to make sure that it actually works?
A lot. And I know typically, you know, we can talk about the one-third skill, one-third concept, one-third play. But what typically happens is you end your practice with some play. Definitely at a rep level, you're probably playing against the team on the other basket for part of it. But I think it's important to have the flow so the athletes can see build-up and you can see build-up as well. The one danger with it, though, is that if you are time poor, you're constantly cutting the same things off the back end of your practice. So it's important, we'll get into review a little bit later, to make sure that they find their way to the start of the next practice, if you need to do that.
I think with your session, though, you know, you talk about planning and it doesn't have to be immaculately done or formatted, and I completely agree. I think something that helps with that time is the review of your game. So if you're a junior coach like a VJBL or domestic and you're not in a space like Bestie and I where we're not coaching games, but you review your game, the things you've seen, the things you think you need to work on, and you just jot those points down, that's almost half your session plan done. So and in that time, that's generally a Friday night or a Saturday, or, you know, so you're not – as time poor, I'm probably making a massive assumption, but you're not as time poor as you would be midweek trying to turn up to practice when you've had work and kids and all that sort of stuff. So that review of your game becomes really important and helps take away some of that workload.
Yep. And there is no better time to review than straight afterwards. Like it's, and I know we all sit in this space as well. The drive home is usually when things are going, okay, now that went right, that went wrong, this we need a little bit of work on. That is the best time to start going over what was good and what was bad. I know I've spoken about it before. I usually have my little Google sheet that I punch everything into, give a rating review on each of the players during the game, but also what went right, what went wrong, what do we need to work on this week at practice, just so I can go back and reference it. So that helps me plan out my training sessions. And it means you don't forget anything. Because that does happen a lot, is that in the heat of the moment, you think fairly clearly that and that, then by 48 hours later you've forgotten what it is as you're trying to plan your training session.
Yeah, what I think is a bit of a, and I suppose I'll pose this as a question to both of you, how much, so when you do that review and you're looking to do your session plan, how much time do you spend on what the kids do well?
Well, I'm a negative person by nature, so no, it's certainly something that I have to be really mindful of, and I mean, I've found it this year as well. I focus a lot in our after-game stuff on things that we have to fix rather than giving props to people that went well. And you know, that's something I have to address, in particular given the age group and the people that I'm coaching. So I have to be acutely aware of what the damage can be done by not highlighting the goods as well as trying to fix the bad. But I am also one of those people that it's like, well, I can get 15 points better out of a 10-point loss, I'm not sure I can get 15 points better after a 10-point win. So I want to try and fix the things that went poorly to try and improve the group.
Great question. I think, where are you at with your team's identity?
Mm.
So if you're at that point where it's established, maybe you don't need to spend as much time on the positives because they know what they are and they know what they do well. But if you're early in your campaign and you feel that their identity is maybe not fully formed and you're trying to find that, you maybe spend a bit more time, you know, pumping up the positives and spending time on it.
You can't ask the question and not have an opinion. Come on.
I think we probably spend, this probably goes against all coaching rules, I think we probably spend a little too much time on the weakness and not enough time on, a lot of this is coming from the role I'm in at the moment in skill development, but not enough time making the good great or the great elite in terms of skill set, because as coaches we're fixers by nature and we want to fix all the things that are wrong. But I think sometimes that gets us athletes that are kind of, they become a jack of all trades and masters of none. So I like to, and sometimes I have to catch myself because, again, I get into that, I want to fix this, I want to fix this, I want to fix this. But I like to try and put in as much as I can of getting to those skill sets of individuals from good to great or great to elite. Because to be honest, for them to move on, and if you're a domestic level coach, your job isn't to create Australian level players. Your job is to have the kids, get the kids into the game, have them enjoy it, and have them want to move on into higher levels. So, you know, I'm probably talking about different things here, but you know, if we want the athletes to, you know, make state teams, make Australian camps, make Australian teams and beyond, they need to be elite at certain skill sets. And if we're not devoting that amount of time to that, then and all on the weakness of the athlete, then, you know, are we holding them back? I don't know. It's just something I ponder at times.
And it's something to take into consideration too. I don't know that we as coaches have too many problems with our players when it comes to game time. Like, that's enjoyable for them. We don't really have to motivate them too much. I think where a lot of the disconnect happens is at training sessions with our athletes, where they're not necessarily doing something they want to do. We as coaches, of course, are doing what we want to do. We've planned out the training session. So trying to find the right content, we can't move players on if they don't turn up to practice.
Absolutely. Like,
we can't improve them if they're not at practice. So we have to find that beautiful balancing act between keeping the kids happy because they want to play games, keeping us happy because we obviously want to improve them, but also keeping parents happy because they're not going to bring their kids to something that is not enjoyable for their kid to go through. So it's a real difficult balancing act, I feel, for coaches that, and again, I'll give away some course content for free on this one because I always do. It is, like, I know when I first started out as a coach, my training sessions were skill development for the first half, give or take. Then we do a little bit of sort of gameplay, but we'd always finish with a game where it was literally just roll the ball out and see what happens and see if they've transferred anything from that training session into the game. And you could bet dollars to donuts the first 15 minutes of the training session when they're doing skill development stuff used to be, can we play a game? Like, when are we going to play a game? And my stubborn 16-year-old self was like, well, when you guys get this stuff right, then we'll start looking at playing a game. When in reality, they were kind of telling me what they wanted to do. They wanted to play more games at their training sessions, which is enjoyable for them, which then it was up to me to find ways to develop their skill set within gameplay rather than saying, no, this is isolated skills practice versus isolated gameplay. There's got to be a blend between the two. I'll ask the question, would you guys ever start a training session with a scrimmage?
Well, we're contemplating doing that for our NPP camp this Saturday, but it's obviously different level of athletes, and we've done some work prior, so they have some structure to fall into. But drawing on some recent experience with our Giddy Daniels Cup, for the first few weeks we started our sessions with a bit of pivoting, passing, habit building, closeout type stuff. And for the first week or two, the energy was good because it was a new program. And then we did a review after our practice and said, you know what, we're just going to throw them in the fire with some two-on-two straight away because we felt our communication off the ball, whether it was go stay calls, wasn't great. So first thing, we do our chat, hands in, quick demo and we're playing straight away. And everyone in the gym was just like, wow, this is phenomenal. Then we stopped it probably 3 or 4 minutes in and said, right, this is the detail that we need in it. And we've adopted that now. So last week we started with some 3-on-3 pick and roll stuff. And that was playing straight away. It was competitive for a score and there was a winner. And then once it was rolling, then we stopped to teach the detail. So different level of athlete and coaches for sure, but there's value in it.
Yeah. For hub visits and camps, so hub visits has been more we're straight into 3-on-3, just play no rules other than no on-balls for 8 minutes. For camps, I put them into teams and they played 5-on-5. Again, no rules, just to let them play. And the standard of the session was so much better when we got to the teaching element. So that play, teach, play theory, I think works. It does take, I suppose, you are having to go on the run a little bit, and that's what we're going to find at this camp that we're hosting on the weekend, is you could plan whatever you want, but at the end of the day, the scrimmage will tell you what you need and then you can adjust from there. So you could be watching the scrimmage and taking notes of, and that's putting your session plan together, taking notes of what you need to work on. But that then has them show you what needs to be done rather than sort of we're going to go in and work on this. They might be already okay at that, but, we're going to spend that time. That's wasted time. So being able to draw out from the play what you need to work on, I think, is fantastic. They love playing straight up, and especially for the country athletes, some of them have probably spent 4 hours in a car, so wakes them up a little bit, gets them into it and ready to go. So, I found it great.
And it's different because some of us are coming into trials as well, and they'll be needing to plan their trial depending on what the structure is at your association. So I wouldn't recommend that for your trial.
No.
I just want to put that out there because there's certain things that you need to evaluate with trials, which is different. So, but once you're in the thick of it, try it. It's fun. Kids love it.
Yeah. It is. And you'll have a little bit of a rough guide as to what could go right or what could go wrong out of that scrimmage anyway. So you can still plan, and it's like, you hit on a bestie, like the stay go calls. It's like, we think this is going to be an issue regardless. Let's put them into scrimmage, see if it actually is. And it's like, okay, it is. So now we know we can go and work on that. So I think it's a really valuable way of just making sure it starts your session with energy. Mm. Like, how many times have we seen it, kids sort of walk in, 6:30 training session, 6:28 they arrive and, they talk for the first 6 minutes of that thing and they're not really doing anything because they're waiting in line. So they're not overly engaged in that session. Whereas if you can go from the very get-go, hey, your warm-up is your responsibility. And again, you guys have a different structure where players can come in, get through their warm-up so that when you guys hit the court, they are ready to go. Mm. I think that's a great way of just getting the energy in your training session straight away. And as coaches, we know the energetic sessions where everyone's up and into it, it's enthusiasm-based. They're the fun ones to be at as a coach. But when you're trying to drive that energy and drive that, come on, get into this, go a little bit harder, that becomes really hard as a coach and draining.
Yeah. And it's different in the pro space, obviously, because they've got all college space because they've got more time with the athletes. But the amount of programs that you see warming up with another sport, just play a little bit of walking rugby or soccer or even gridiron. We did that a little bit in Tassie when it was freezing in the morning. I'd bring American football and we just play two teams, keepings off for the first 5 minutes. Obviously, we had some structure around tackling and and those types of things, but automatically everyone was like, oh, yep, we're ready to go. So once again, it's about budgeting your time though, obviously, because you don't have, what have you got, 2 1.5-hour practices maybe for a rep team.
Yeah, well,
and budgeting your coins. Like some of those gyms in Tassie, you still need to put the $2 over on the side.
It's important.
Sure. Yeah.
It's important.
It all matters. So when we're looking at planning our training sessions, how do you guys, are there any programs that you use to plan out a training session? Like, what do you use? Are you pen and paper? Are you computer? If you're computer, what are you using in that space?
I just use Excel. I've got my template and I put drills into that. So I haven't outlaid any, money on anything to help me do it. I've just set up a template that I'm comfortable with. And I think that's important to make sure that it's something that works for you, that you can read quickly, you know where the information is. And I think sometimes with session plans we can get a little too over the top with it, with all the things that we include on it from an aesthetic point of view. At the end of the day, you need how much time you're going to commit to which drill and what you're trying to get out of it. And that's pretty much it. So, you know, having things like if you're going to scrimmage of some sort or you're going to do anything, you know, having your teams ready rather than, you know, you go in that group, you go in that group, you go in that group, because as weird as it is, some kids can get a little upset by being the last person assigned to a group and things like that. So if you can just read out a group of players and that's already set, saves time, you know, all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I don't use a program as such. I just use my template on Excel.
Yeah, in this current role, I just use Excel. But when I was the development manager for Casey, I used Practice Plan Alive. And that was purely because I would run all of our sessions on a Sunday like a camp. So we would have our age groups together and I wanted to actually track how much time we were spending on certain things per age group. And that program allowed you to do that. So then when I would watch that age group play on a Friday night, I could say, well, we're no good at X. You go back and look and say, well, we're not spending any time on it. So like that is why it was valuable. And it also allowed the coaches in the age group to see the value behind why we're spending times on things. So for now in this role, I use Excel or Word. But if I was head of a program, I really highly recommend Practice Plan Live.
Yep, makes a lot of sense. And what it does allow you to do, like the practice plan and stuff, but also the Excel and Word, gives you a great little database of drills that you can just copy and paste over the years too. Like that's not something that you need to reinvent the wheel or wheel out the same stuff and retype it. It's just a case of, okay, we haven't done this for 3 or 4 weeks now. We need that drill back in to go and address whatever you're trying to address in that space. So I think it is a great way to do it. It's a great resource to have. I'm assuming you guys have your session plans from like the last however many years you guys have been coaching anyway that you can go back over. I know I got sent one the other day by one of my assistant coaches that I've had previously. Shout out to Dave Peters, who's currently trying to fill the big shoes that you've left Dan and Casey Bestie. But
Practice Plan Alive was set up for him, ready to go. Yeah,
very easy on his end. But he sent me through one of my old practice plans, which was done on Microsoft Word and had way too much detail in there. Like there was everything in that thing down to what equipment we needed, what time this is going to be through, like a ridiculous amount of detail on what the drill was, where it's like, actually, I don't need to put all that in. I know what the drill is. But it also had things like every assistant coach was assigned a role within a drill, like, you know, Zoe, you're going to be looking at the offensive side of things. Bestie, you're on the defensive side of things. Other coach will be taking care of this. And whilst it's good to have in that you know coaches are now going to be focused on something that you want out of the drill, sometimes it's like, well, if I'm the offensive coach but I see something on defense, should I be saying anything? Like, where's the line in that as well? So you do have to be a little careful that you don't go over the top. Like, as much as we talk about planning practice is valuable and really important, you can overdo it as well, and it becomes more of a hindrance, I think, than a help in some spaces.
I don't think there's an issue with assigning assistant coaches roles. I think it's actually a good thing. I think it doesn't stop them from, you know, I wouldn't go into just something like offense and defense. I'd say, you know, from the defensive side of the ball, you're on the hands above the ball or the footwork or something like that. Then they can still speak about anything else from an offensive or defensive perspective, but that's their point of emphasis to make sure as soon as they see that's not getting done, they've got to pull that athlete aside and explain it or show it again or whatever needs to happen. But I think if we don't give assistant coaches roles at times, it's hard for them to know what they can and can't say. So I think it's a really good exercise for involving them in the session as well and giving them some ownership of the session.
Yep. So what are some of the must-haves in every training session? Like, what are the things that you have to have this in every training session regardless of what's going on? You spoke about it before, Bestie, like that 90 minutes, 60 minutes tends to be roughly what our VJBL coaches get. Our domestic coaches, you're probably getting 60 minutes on a half court with a team that might or might not be in the same age group that you might not be able to scrimmage against. But what are some of the things that you have to have in every training session?
Well, for me, like, everyone touches on the Fab Five at some point, right? Like, so I think the you know, your pivot pass, all that stuff has to be in there, but it's how you work it in there, which is what I alluded to earlier. Just doing it stationary maybe isn't the way to go, which will challenge you as a coach to be able to coach some skill within a concept. At the moment, I'm really big on floor balance, which is the receiver-based stuff, so that would need to be in every practice for me, has to be in there. Some element of competitiveness defensively. So whether it's a closeout into some one-on-one and maybe finishing the possession with a block out, something like that. And then age group dependent, how much time you spend on offense. I know we're not going to spend too much on team-based offense in 12s, and it gradually improves as you go up 14, 16s, 18s. But, yeah, you've got to have some skill base, some decision-making, some understanding of how to balance the floor, always a competitive element with some one-on-one, two-on-two. But ultimately, it all has to fit into how you want to play. But and we touched on this, I think, last week with shooting drills around the types of shots that your offense generates. So make sure that if you are doing shooting drills, which we know it should be a big chunk of your practice, it needs to be relevant to the types of shots that those athletes are going to get through your offense.
33% of their sessions should be shooting, according to Coops last week.
Not one percentage less.
Not one percentage less. Okay. Zoe, what about you? What are some of the must-haves in your training sessions?
I agree with shooting. You know, we can't sit here and bang on about it being the master skill, and if you can shoot, you can play anywhere and all that sort of stuff, and then not allocate the time to it. And I think what's really important when you are including shooting into your session plan is making sure that it's not just shooting the ball, because if you're not doing something like form shooting, for instance, and you're trying to get bang for your buck, and that's where games approach coaching comes into it, and I suppose we could go down that track maybe a bit later, but you need to coach the technique through whether it's contested shooting, whether it's, you know, on-air shooting. You need to coach the technique regardless, so they can take it away with them, because they'll shoot the ball without us more than they will with us. So they need to be able to coach themselves. So it's really important that we don't just set them up in a contested shooting drill and then just let them go. You know, we've still got to be, you know, on top of that as we would be if they were form shooting, for example. But went off on a little tangent there. Apologies. But yes, definitely shooting. Completely agree with competitiveness, especially on the defensive end. Something I like to use for that is, you know, whether we're doing a one-on-one or a two-on-two or some type of drill, or even just a boxing out drill or whatever that might be, we always play it back to the half court. So stop or a score, we play it back to the half. And that just helps with that transition of O to D and D to O as well. And that the drill's not just done. You know, we see a lot, you know, the shot goes up, someone rebounds it and they, you know, sort of walk off. It's not just done. You've got to play it still and have that competitiveness. And I put penalties on if the ball gets to the halfway line in a certain amount of dribbles or less, then there's penalties for the defense, because that means they haven't switched on and they haven't, you know, if it gets there within three dribbles or less, then they have a penalty. I think the defensive focus, I think you can attack both the O and the D at the same time. That's where your roles of your assistant coaches come in, if you're lucky enough to have one. Otherwise, that's where your session plan becomes really important. Can your constraints, if you're by yourself, can your constraints do your coaching for you? So, for instance, from a defensive perspective, you know, if you send them below or above the push points that you've set out, so whether it's above the elbow, it's a wing penetration, for example. If you send them above the elbow or below the low hash mark, that's a point for you. If from an offensive perspective, you can get between those push points within two dribbles, that's a point for you. So that starts to do the coaching for you, because they'll start to figure out ways to get that done. So if you're undermanned or under-resourced, that can, like, I can't stress how important constraints are to helping you coach without having to speak.
And that's a great one. We did that on Sunday. This is the reason I lost my voice with FDP. We were working on some shell and defending a pass and cut because it was under 14, so it's relevant. And the rule was if the offense scored on a pass and a face cut, the game was over. Game was over, losing team had a short penalty and we start again.
Yep.
So automatically the kids were jumping to the ball, hand was in the passing lane, it was fantastic. So that's exactly what Zoe was saying. As soon as I said you must play some one-on-one, I just wanted to reiterate that doesn't mean it has to be a shot with a one-on-one. So I, as we go into the younger age groups, I encourage the coach or another player to be a viable outlet in the one-on-one. So if there isn't a good shot, they can pass it out and then maybe lead for the ball again as opposed to just jumping off 1 foot, I have to shoot it at all costs type scenario.
So. Do you put like a, you know, you can only pass it out X amount of times before it's a dead possession?
I would if I was with a lower skill base than what I'm currently working with. Yep. You know, with the NPP, SDP kids, it's typically not. You know, you might get one pass out, that would be it. But yes, if it was under 10s, under 12s, 14s, I probably would, yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. That makes sense. So when you guys are putting together your session plans, how long is too long on a drill? Because this is something that we get a fair bit. And, I mean, even the word drill in itself can be a little misleading because it gives the implication that's like, you know, repetitiveness over and over and over again, and it has to be done the same way. It's like that got that military feel to it, like with a drill. But how long, if we're talking activities, for example, how long is too long?
I think anything over 10 minutes is too long. I think, I suppose I'm a little bit different in how I set up a session plan. So I'm a less drills, more layers session plan. So I might do the same activity for 10 minutes, but there will be, you know, three or four different layers. So the start, the first activity looks completely different to the end activity, but it's still the same activity, if that makes sense. So, but yeah, I'd say anything over 10 minutes is probably too long because we're all time poor. We want to work on multiple things, but also they'll start to zone out to what you're doing and you want to try and keep it fresh and move on to other things to keep them engaged.
Yeah, I agree. And layering is the key. So if we stick with my example of shell drill, maybe the first 5 minutes is defending the pass and cut, and then the second 5 minutes might be they're allowed to set a ball screen and we're working on hustling, or maybe it's a show and recover or whatever it is. So it's about trying to layer more into the concept or the drill as such, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and you could layer it anyway. You could layer it like changing the skill. You could layer it from one-on-one into two-on-one into two-on-two into, you know, there's a million different ways you can layer it just to keep it fresh and work on different things. But, yeah, it's really important to in keeping them engaged.
Yep. I know I've certainly run four-on-four for an entire session of under 12 kids and they wouldn't have had a clue. Like, they just thought it was hilarious that we just kept doing something different. It's like, kids, this is four-on-four. Like, this is not complicated stuff. Like, but it was all disadvantage work. Like, and that's probably an area I'm looking to tap into now is that the transition side of the basketball. Like, we do tend to get a half court for a lot of our training sessions, those that coach in the VJBL and domestic. If you see a full court for more than about 25 minutes, you are one of the blessed few in Victoria that can possibly get that. So you touched on a little bit, Zoe, with you've got to play it to half court. But how do you work on something like transition basketball to training session when you never get to see a full court to use to get that transition into? Zoe, you got this.
Okay, yeah. it's difficult. So one of the things I've tried to do in the past is break it down a little bit. So, you know, we will actually break down the ripping it out of the net, taking it out of bounds, getting open and playing to the half court as best we can. Depending on the age group, then it'd be play to the half court, then hand it over and now you're on D coming back the other way, you know, again for another sort of transition element to it. Unfortunately, without the ability to use a half court, it does become difficult just doing piece by piece in that half court. So if you can, as Bestie said, jump in with another group for, you know, if you've got an hour and a half and they've got an hour and a half, maybe there's a half hour crossover where you can train together and use the full court or something like that to really help with that sort of stuff. The main place I would teach transition would be in, or full court transition would be actually in the games. So I'd have to really coach that throughout the games and remind them of, you know, placings and balance and all that sort of stuff, because that is where we would obviously consistently see a full court.
Let's take it. So we're in an ideal world and we've got all 10 players for both teams. So there's 20 kids on the court, you know, 10 at each end. The way you can get the best bang for buck is to play some 3 or 5 way from your group, as opposed to just playing 5-on-5 and there's 10 kids sitting on the sideline for multiple times. So the way it would work is you would start at your end in the half and you might go down, back, or maybe it's just half down, back. And then that's your opportunity to coach while the other group at the other end then goes down, half, down, back. So we call that 3-way or 5-way. I think that is probably the best way to be able to work it in. And you can do that even if the team on the other basket is a different age group or gender. So you might not be able to combine with them to play a game, but they could still get some reps in the full court and you could still get some reps in the full court, which you could do 4-on-4, 3-on-3 as well.
Yep. And so much of our game is transition. It's losing the ball and having to get back on defense or somehow coming up with the ball and going to play offense. You don't always get a half court set every possession, but you will always get transition of some sort in that space. So all the things like how you take the ball out of the net, how the guard catches it, are they looking to kick that thing ahead? The transition side of things is probably a fairly undertaught area of the game, purely from a logistics perspective. We don't have that full court defensive transition. Like we saw the MPP girls scrimmage last night, which started at a frenetic pace for the first 6 minutes, and everyone was cooked after 6 minutes, and they still had 3 quarters and a bit to go. But what became super important there was the defensive transition, pulling up the ball, keeping it to a sideline, not allowing it to just cross the seams constantly. So please don't discount the working on the transition side. So I know I do a lot of numerical disadvantage stuff at my training sessions, so 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3, to just try and simulate how it will potentially look in a game situation. And you can change up so many things with that. You can change where the ball starts from, the direction you might start with the offense facing away from their basket, but then having to snap around and quickly survey the floor, work out what's best for them. Defensively, you've got to hustle a little bit because obviously numerically you're up against it. You might add in an extra player can come in from the side after 5 seconds to play defense to try and give a little bit of an incentive to hold the ball up as long as you can because there's help coming. But I find it really helps the offense because they should be able to think their way through what's going on and where the space is and how they go and attack it. But the defense has to hustle a little bit harder too. So I think the numerical advantage games at a training session are really valuable. And I know coaching at the Under 14 Academy this year, we've done nothing on air. And you know, thankfully, Coops probably won't listen to this podcast where he cracks it at me for not doing enough form shooting at a training session. But we've
33%.
Done 33%. I can assure you it's probably less than that. But we've done a lot of finishing, so that might contribute towards that a little bit. But we've done nothing on air this year. Everything has been disadvantage stuff where, you know, when you start on like the Chris Paul starts, which is like the offense, starting with the ball on the back of the defense who's facing the basket and having to go from there. We've done some stuff with... defense has to go touch half court before they're allowed to get back in the offensive system. Like an offensive player starts in a trail type spot where they can, you know, throw the ball behind them just to allow them a little bit of creativity as well. Well, because we do want to encourage that flair where they can have a little bit of fun with it. But what it does do is it really ramps up the intensity of the training session because now it's competitive all the time. They don't have that stand around and chat time. And, you know, I've always been a massive proponent of the biggest killer for any training session is lines. Like when you've got your kids waiting in lines, that's when bad stuff happens. They either disengage with the session or they re-engage with one of their teammates and then you never get them back into the training session because they muck around or whatever the case may be. So the more activity you can get with those kids and getting through a session, I think the better off they're going to be and the more engaged they're going to be. And it just makes it a more fun session for everyone in that space.
The lines thing really resonated with me after some conversations with David Munns.
Yep.
So... for those that don't know, David Munns used to write all the curriculum for Aussie Hoops and FIBA coach, all of those lovely things. He told me once you set up your drill, take a step back and just watch one athlete through a full cycle of it. And if he's standing for more than 30 seconds at any time, your drill's broken and you need to add another layer of some sort. And I've taken that on. Now, sometimes it's unavoidable, as we know. But just to have that in the back of your mind, yep, for sure.
Yep. Yeah, makes sense. So imagine your session's going along, life is pretty good, and all of a sudden you just get this real feel of it's not where it needs to be. Competitive might have dropped off. It's just not flat, but you just sort of feel like something's not quite working. How quickly would you change a drill, bestie, if you just get that feel that it's just not going well? Would you persist with it, or would you just say, no, shelve this, we'll move on to something else, just to try and keep the energy of the session high?
Age group and yep, skill dependent. Obviously, I think the older you get and the level that you get, a quick huddle and a reminder of why we're doing it can work. I know definitely with our state level kids that is often enough. But with the younger kids, yeah, if you see it just not where it is, I would say probably 5 to 6 minutes and then maybe you need to move on.
Yep, absolutely. So Zoe, how would you get competitive into your training session if you feel it just sort of drop off a little bit? Like, would you go straight into a quick 2 minute scrimmage or something like that, is there anything else you'd try?
Yeah, so I think that's where, again, games approach comes into it. I think if you... I like to be a games approach coach, and I think that naturally brings the competitive element into the session because they're doing something they enjoy, which you're tricking them into thinking that they're just playing games when really you're working on, as Bestie said before, skills within concepts and within gameplay. So I think that takes a lot of that out. Obviously, there are exceptions that prove the rule. So if I'm already in games approach, a games approach drill and competitive drops off, I'll change a constraint. So I'll add a point for something, you know, whether it be an offensive board, or I'll add a point for good box outs, or I'll take a point away or something. You know, I think I always try and say with games approach, you work off the three C's. So competitiveness, every drill has to be competitive, whether it be to time, to score, to, you know, first two, whatever. There has to be an element of competition. Constraints, as I've mentioned already, helps you coach without speaking. And then critique through questioning. So ask them why they think these things aren't happening. Is there too much in the... 'cause sometimes there might be too much in the drill. You know, there might be too much for them to think about that... And I see it in girls in particular. They, you know, especially when you start to teach things like same foot, same hand finishes and that sort of stuff, because they're focused so hard on trying to get that right, because it's not instinct for them, because it's not your base fundamental footwork. Everything before that, they're going to do probably at a half pace because they want to get that part right. So... you know, is there too much in it? And you get that information by asking the questions like, hey, how come, you know, I wanted you to go here first before getting on the rim and making that finish. Why didn't you? And see what comes back. And then I think a big part of it is shelving the ego a little bit and being willing to adjust to make it an environment that they can be successful in.
If you find yourself coaching the organization of your drill, not what's within it, it's too complicated for your group.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Yep. You know, like, you give yourself 30, 40 seconds, you know, to see if it's working. And then if you just constantly, you've got to pass it and then go there, and you've got to do this and then go there, you know, you're not fulfilling the role of a coach.
Yep.
You know, it's too complicated for that group.
Oh, I really like that. That's very good. So what I'm curious about, can coaches over-talk at their training sessions?
Yes.
Can you... Okay.
Sorry.
I
thought that was it.
No. Well, it's obvious, but
because it's a big problem.
Yeah. How can they do it? How can they fix it? What are the things they need to be aware of then?
So, apologies. Yes, they can. To help fix it, and to be honest, I sometimes am a victim of this too. I still do this at times. The best way I found to help fix it is to mic yourself up during a session. Film the session, go back and listen to yourself and watch it and time how much time the kids are actually in training versus listening to you standing there and speaking. And it was really, really bad for me early when I was young into coaching, where I had all this information I wanted to get out and thought I had to give it all at once, rather than now that's where layers can help you, because you can get into something, work on an element, add the layer, which gives you another element, add the layer, which gives you, so you're not having to do all that talking all at once. I think making sure as well, you know, do you think about whether before you stop a drill, do you need to stop it for everybody, or do you, can you just pull out one or two athletes and talk to them on the side while the drill's still going? And often you might have to say, as you pull those two kids out, you might have to say, keep going, because they'll all look at you. but, or, you know, can you flight path coach them? You know, can you walk in between where they're going if they're going back to where they have to start? Can you walk in between them, say what you have to say and keep going? You know, we don't always have to stop everyone to have everyone listen to something, because, you know, 8 of your 10 might know it or might be doing it right. So why stop them from continuing to get better to talk to two when you could just pull them out to the side, or have an assist, again, have an assistant coach, you know, at one end be able to grab them, or however you want to structure it. But I think we definitely can fall victim to over speaking, and it comes from a good place because we're trying to fix things and we're trying to, you know, give as much information as we can. But yeah, I think mic yourself up, video your session, and then put the timer on and you'll be surprised.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is have the ability to reduce your drill or your concept or whatever you're working. So if it's 4-on-4 and things, you know, there's some athletes that need some coaching along the way, can you reduce it to 3-on-3? So then there is automatically some players subbing out that you can have some conversations with, or flight path coaching. But I love Lono's praise, prompt, leave.
Yep.
You know, in and out, praise, prompt, leave.
Yep.
You know, and that's resonated with me.
Yep. And it is a case of less is more. Like a lot of times we're trying to cover our own backside, I suppose, a little bit with the coach. Look, I gave them all the information and they couldn't do it, so it's not on me. Like, no, it is on you because you gave them the wrong information, or you delivered it the wrong way. So I know I stole it from, I think, Darren Anderson. We were talking about it one day. So we were talking about how long we would structure a drill for, and sort of like 8 to 10 minutes is around about that sort of sweet spot for how long it would be. The first 3 minutes, tell them what you want, let them go and do it, and take a step back. Sort of similar to what you were talking about before, Bestie. And in that time, that's when you get to evaluate, and that's when you get to sort of say, okay, we don't need to address that because that's already covered, but we do need to address this. You've got 2 minutes. Like, get in for 2 minutes, address what you need to address, preferably less, but 2 minutes is about the most, where you can jump in, make your adjustments, and then jump out of the drill again. And then for the last three, however many minutes after that, work it out. Okay, has my coaching actually made a difference here? Like, because if it hasn't, your message is either jumbled or it was the wrong message in that space as well. So you do have to self-evaluate a little bit there. But I know coaches can fall victim to that over-talking to the point where your kids can tune out. And all of a sudden they've lost interest in the session, and it becomes a flat session after that. They've now got too much information, or they're bored. Like, you know, we talk to our kids a fair bit during games, and the last thing we want is for them to tune out to the message that's coming through, because all we do is talk. How much are they really hearing? Probably 30% of what we're giving them, maybe less, depending on the age group. But you've got to be really careful that you don't overdo it as well.
Yeah. Well, it's the same for senior athletes in reverse. So when I coached a senior group, and we had some older players, and we're in Tassie, and they said to me, Darren, like, once we get warm, we can't stop. Like, you know, it was not a problem for the younger players, and, you know, we had the import or whatever, and it was like, you just got to suck it up.
Yeah.
You know? But I was like, okay, so when we were going to do our teaching, we did it all at the start of practice, walkthroughs in full, you know, track suits because it's freezing. And then once we got going, it was just rolling. And then just prompting. So for those, if there is anyone listening that coaches seniors as well, as a senior player, once you get going, you don't want to stop.
Yeah.
So if you are going to do your teaching, do it at the start before they're warm, and then it's just a quick review while they're still going.
Yeah. And I know it's kind of ironic we're sitting here literally just talking for an hour, but I think something that's really important, which I suppose wheels back to the topic we're speaking about, is that's where your session plan becomes important. Because if you stick to the detail that's on your session plan, that will reduce the amount that you'll feel you'll need to speak because you'll have those points set out that you want to cover and that you want to hit on. So if you hit on those, you know, you should be happy. So then, you know, it stops you, it keeps you focused and keeps you in line and stop going off on tangents like we do all the time.
Absolutely. Well, and it comes back down to the planning though, as you say, like if you've got that plan written out and you know roughly when you should be moving on to something, if there's been something that potentially hasn't worked, you know, okay, I've got to move on. But by the same token, if it's something that's really important to your session and you realize, actually, I need to spend more time on this, but I've got a little bit of sort of room later on in the session, you can stick with it and you just adjust your plan. Like it's those times where it's like, look, I have to get through all 10 of these drills in my 60-minute session. You're probably not getting through all 10 of those drills. Or you will, but you'll half-ass something somewhere and you won't get out what you need to get out of it. So it is something to be really mindful of. How much time would you spend on your team and their development versus focusing on an upcoming team that you're about to play against? So I know we've discussed like the concepts and those types of things, but Bestie, how much time would you spend on your team versus an opposition team?
Are we assuming that this is the last practice before we
play that let's team? Go with that. Yep. What's deep ponder? He's leaned back in the chair as well and he's Mr.
You
Burns.
You almost need the sound effect.
Yeah, well,
close.
So, and we haven't done any film or anything.
Correct? No, nothing like that.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
Okay. Probably 20 minutes.
Yep.
You know, if I'm thinking a VJBL sort of level, but if it was obviously state level or anything like that, or seniors, you know, we would have already done film, scouting report, those types of things. And hopefully you have in your preparation through the season some ways to defend common actions that you can then layer into what's being ran. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, you should have some confidence knowing that you know how you've got one or two ways to defend an off-ball screen. You've got one or two ways to defend a cross screen or whatever it might be. So you can say, they do this and we know this is how we defend it. We've got these two ways. Whereas if you just think about only defending their offense as such, you probably need more time, is what I would say.
Any different?
From a junior perspective, I probably wouldn't spend too much time because like Bessie just said, I'd like to rely on our rules and have that in place. What I might do is if we were coming up against, again in juniors, a player, and we've actually done this with the senior women, is, you know, if we know someone is just ultra right-handed, for example, well, you know, struggles going left, doesn't want to go left, I'll put a drill in where the offense can only score on their right hand. So that forces them to only use their right. Now they've got to only defend the right and send them left. So it's sort of teaching them that scout without taking up space in their head, I guess. And then, you know, I might do it just for the players that I think will end up on them or give everyone a go at it, depending on sort of, I suppose, the level of kids and the age that I've got. But, yeah, running that sort of drill, which is a scout, but it's I'm not telling them it's something added that they have to, again, find space in their head for. And then when it comes to the game time, I can say, hey, this is that drill. This is she's only going to try and score on her right. You must send her left. If she scores on her left, that's on me. I'll wear it. And then, you know, again, sit back and rely on the rules. I did do film when I was coaching 18s. I did show them a little bit of film, not too much. And then, yeah, we'd maybe walk through their offense just to show them. But other than that, it'd be more about us.
All right. So we'll stick with you on this one, Zoe. So how much input do you give your players into your training sessions? Like, do you consult with them at all or do you just do your thing?
Yeah, so I'll consult with them. So NPP the other week, I actually said to the girls, what do you feel like you need to work on for next week? And they threw out some things that they wanted. Thankfully, it aligned. But, you know, from a senior perspective, I'll give them a lot more, I guess, of a say, especially when we are talking about something like a scout or, you know, hey, this is how I think we should defend it. What do you think? And, you know, I've had Bree Wattman, one of the most enjoyable point guards I've ever had to coach, who said, hey, that's a long way to go to then, you know, if we do come up with the ball, then have to handle the ball coming down the floor, Like that is a that's too far to have to guard. And so we worked together to find an answer on that. And I said to her, but if this doesn't work, we're going back to this. So you still have to know it. And she's like, yep, no worries. Having that, then she then gained a bit of ownership over it. And then she started coaching it too, because she knew she didn't want to have to do that. So she made sure everybody knew the new way and did it properly. I think that can be really powerful. Seniors is obviously a different ball game to juniors, but I think a really good, I suppose it's sort of skewing away from training, but a really good thing to ask your athletes, especially in things like timeouts, is what are you seeing? You know, what are they doing to you defensively? And have them tell you. So, you know, they're overplaying the lane. Okay, so what do we do? Back cut. Okay, good. So now you know that they know it. It's not just you dumping information on them, and it's starting to teach them to actually read what's going on rather than, you know, but the offense says I'm supposed to go here. Well, no, if they're overplaying that, you make that read. So I think giving players ownership to a point is never a bad thing, and asking them things that they want to have included in sessions, I think – obviously, to a point, but I think it can be powerful, and it can give them that ownership, and then that competitiveness and engagement in the session goes up.
Any different, Bestie?
No, it's all age and level dependent. You know, with seniors, the level of comfort creates buy-in. So if they have ownership, they're more comfortable, and then it generates buy-in. With the juniors, obviously, you can lead them to the path through pointed questioning, I think, yeah.
Yep. I think that's really key, that pointed questioning stuff. Like, you can get more out of asking them a question than you having to give them the answer. That push versus pull is so powerful for our youth athletes in particular, because it makes them feel like they've come up with the answer, which means it's probably more likely to stick with them. Everyone remembers when they get something right. Everyone tries to shelve when they've got something wrong and they forget about that one. So I think that's a really valuable one. That does wrap us up for today. So thank you guys for jumping into it. Bestie, we'll get you a Strepsils sponsorship or something like that by the time you roll back through to the next podcast. Coaches, good luck with your coaching. We hope it goes well. Hopefully that's some valuable stuff that you can use when you're planning out your training sessions. The moral of the story is please plan your training sessions. Turn up with a session plan, whether it be typed up, whether it be notes on your phone, whatever the case may be. Always have something in place for your athletes, just to make sure that they get something out of the session and it's the right things out of the session. We never want to sit there and say, oh, I don't know what I'm doing today, so we're just going to play knockout for the first 55 minutes of our training session. Probably not going to get you any better as a free throw shooting team. So try and manage it so that you can get what you need out of your training sessions. Coaches, we do appreciate all the likes, subscribes, subscriptions, all that sort of stuff. Keep sharing the podcast. You can get us with the hashtag Talking Split if you need us. Thank you very much for jumping in, and good luck with your coaching. Look, tune in, enjoy the tribe.